You're listening to a University of Minnesota Bookstore author event podcast, recorded live from our location in Kauffman Memorial Union on the U of M's Twin Cities campus. For more information on upcoming author events, please visit our website at bookstore.umn.edu.
Our guest today is Elaine Tyler May, Regents Professor of American Studies and History at the University of Minnesota. She is the author of several books, including Homeward Bound, American Families in the Cold War Era, and Barren in the Promised Land, Childless Americans and the Pursuit of Happiness. She has served as president of the American Studies Association and president of the Organization of American Historians. She lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she's here today to talk about her new book, America and the Pill. Please join me in welcoming Elaine Tyler May.
It's so nice to see you all here on such a beautiful day. You're not outside enjoying the gorgeous weather and fall colors. So thank you very much for coming. And thank you also for putting up with a rather squeaky voice. I'll keep sipping water, but I'm trying to drown out a cold that's made a mess of my voice, so forgive me for that. But I would like to start with a much better voice than mine. That of Loretta Lynn, who in 1975 wrote and sang this country western song, which is an anthem of appreciation to the birth control pill for the liberation that it offered to women. So we'll start with a musical interlude. Okay, we'll have another musical interlude in a few more minutes. But for now, I think Loretta Lynn sets the stage really nicely for the story of the pill and for the talk I'll be giving. And hopefully you could hear the lyrics because they're really interesting. I mean, they're very 70s, but they're also very pertinent. The song tells the story of a woman whose dreams of marital bliss and adventure have been thwarted by constant childbearing. Resentful of her husband, whose prenuptial promises went unfulfilled as she stayed home to tend to their brood, she declares her independence with sexy clothes and good times thanks to the pill. But she does not abandon her mate. On the contrary, if you listened carefully to that last stanza, the last verse of the song is an invitation to a night of sexual pleasure. She says, "The feeling good comes easy now. Tonight's too good to be real. Oh, Daddy, don't you worry none, 'cause Mama's got the pill." The song articulates the hopes for liberation the pill offered to women. And like the vast majority of women who took the pill, especially in the 1960s, the song's protagonist was married. And the pill offered her the chance once again to reach for her dreams. By the time Loretta Lynn sang that song, the birth control pill had been on the market for 15 years, and millions of women were taking it every day. As Lynn's song suggests, the story of the pill is a story about women. Well, that fact may seem obvious today, but when the pill first came on the market in 1960, few people who were really involved in its advocacy and development imagined how powerful a force for women's emancipation it would become. If we turn back the clock to the years when the pill was being developed, we find that researchers had great hopes for the pill. And they're not necessarily the hopes we would imagine if we were just imagining it at this moment in time. In 1954, for example, one of the pioneering clinicians who was involved in the research that was developing the pill, this is six years before the FDA approval, 1954, this is John Rock. Some of you may know his name. He's often associated with being one of the pioneering figures involved in developing the pill. Well, John Rock said in 1954, quote, "If an oral contraceptive could be discovered soon, the H-bomb need never fall. It would be the greatest aid ever discovered to the happiness and security of individual families, indeed to mankind. The greatest menace to world peace and decent standards of life today is not atomic energy, but sexual energy." Rock's utopian dreams for the pill were widely shared by others involved in its development. But in spite of their optimism, they faced daunting roadblocks. In many states, including Massachusetts, where John Rock practiced, contraceptives were illegal. No government agency would invest in it, not the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation or any other agency would contribute any money to contraceptive research. President Dwight D. Eisenhower said at the time, quote, "I cannot imagine anything more emphatically a subject that is not a proper political or government activity or function or responsibility. The government will not, so long as I am here, have a positive political doctrine in its program that has to do with the problem of birth control. That is not our business." He changed his mind, interestingly enough, later on when Kennedy was president, first Catholic president, interestingly enough, who actually incorporated birth control into foreign policy. But that was after the pill was already on the market. The pharmaceutical industry in the 1950s was equally hostile, believe it or not. Companies were unwilling to provide any funds for research and development for fear that they would face boycotts and hostility from the Catholic Church, among others who were hostile to birth control. They went on to make gazillions on birth control pill. So who made it happen? Two women made it happen. Although there is considerable competition over who merits the title father of the pill, there is no father of the pill. In fact, the pill had two mothers, and they were Margaret Sanger, birth control pioneer, and Catherine McCormick, the wealthy widow of the son of Cyrus McCormick, who was the founder of the International Harvester Company. These two women met in the early 20th century as women's rights activists. In the 1950s, when they were both elderly women in their 70s, they came together determined to find a way to develop an oral contraceptive. They first found scientist Gregory Pincus. McCormick was a biologist by training. She was one of the first women to graduate from MIT. She graduated in 1902 with a degree in biology. And she remained an avid and serious biologist all of her life. She was impressed with Pincus's research, and she provided the funding that eventually yielded the pill. In fact, she bankrolled the pill pretty much single-handedly. She poured millions of her own money into the development at a time when no one else would invest. So she really, more than anyone else, deserves credit for it. The two women then turned to John Rock. Pincus was the laboratory scientist who worked on developing the hormones and testing them on mice. And John Rock was the physician, who I quoted earlier, who would be the first to direct the first human trials. In the spring of 1960, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the oral contraceptive for marketing. It's a very dramatic story, but I can talk about it later if you have questions about it. The pill's arrival marked the culmination of years of development and testing and heralded a new era in the long history of birth control. For the first time, a method of contraception separated birth control technology from the act of sexual intercourse, and if taken properly, was nearly 100% effective. Women wasted no time demanding prescriptions, a surprise to doctors who normally told their patients what to take, not the other way around. By 1964, the pill was the most popular contraceptive in the country, used by more than 6.5 million married women, 1/4 of all couples using contraception, and untold numbers of married women, untold literally because we don't know, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We don't know how many unmarried women took it. We only know about married women. Although Sanger and McCormick understood the potential for the pill to liberate women, most of the pill's early advocates, developers, and manufacturers did not see it as a tool for women's emancipation. For them, like for John Rock, you remember that quote I opened with, the pill promised to solve the problems of the world. In 1960, those problems seemed daunting. The nation was in the midst of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, locked in a battle for the hearts and minds and markets and political alliances of peoples around the world. Former colonies were gaining their independence while two superpowers vied for their allegiance. American officials feared that communism might take hold in the developing world as a result of widespread poverty, resulting in large part, they believed, from the rapidly rising global population. They also feared that overpopulation could lead to human misery, unrest, violence, and war. At home, the nation was in the midst of the baby boom. Couples married young and had children quickly. Yet American women were becoming restless. They were eager for a reliable contraceptive that would free them from the constant childbearing so they could take advantage of new opportunities that were beginning to open up for women outside the home. At the same time, the sexual revolution was churning just below the surface of domestic tranquility. Despite the taboo against premarital intercourse and the widespread celebration of marriage and family, sex was already escaping from its marital confines. A youth culture was emerging that would challenge many of the social, political, and sexual norms of the past, and the feminist movement was on the horizon. In 1960, when the Food and Drug Administration approved the pill, the forces swirling around its arrival clashed in thunderous clamor. While some observers and commentators feared that the pill would wreak havoc on morals and sexual behavior, others saw it as a magic bullet that would cure the social, sexual, and political ills of the day. By reducing the population, it would remove the conditions that might lead developing nations to embrace communism. By freeing married couples from fears of unwanted pregnancy, it would foster planned and happy families, the key to social order. But freedom from unwanted pregnancy also allowed women to control their fertility so that they could take advantage of new opportunities for education and jobs. When the birth control pill arrived on the market, it unleashed a contraceptive revolution. For the first time, women had access to an effective form of birth control that did not require men's cooperation or even their knowledge. For women, having full control over contraception was a mixed blessing because it also relieved men of any responsibility for preventing pregnancy and left the burden of risk on women. At the same time, the pill also brought a third party into the equation, the doctor. Although the diaphragm also involved medical intervention for the initial fitting, after that there was no need to see a doctor. The pill, however, required regular checkups and monitoring. A doctor had to authorize every prescription and every refill. At first, few women complained about this medical intervention. But the pill also empowered women to make demands on their physicians, initially by asking for prescriptions and then later by insisting on more information and safer oral contraceptives. Within a few years of the FDA approval, as side effects and dangers became apparent, Women came to realize that while the pill might solve some of their problems, it could also create many more. As the feminist movement gained momentum, women's health advocates protested against pharmaceutical companies and demanded government action to develop a safer oral contraceptive. And of course, safer oral contraceptives did develop, and they're much safer now than they were 50 years ago. Women were not the only ones affected by the pill. For every woman taking or contemplating the pill, of course, there was at least one man involved. Men responded to the pill primarily through media spokesmen and experts who took up the social, sexual, and moral implications of oral contraceptives. While some men found it liberating to be free of the possibility of impregnating their partners, others found the power and autonomy that it gave to women threatening to their masculine egos. Among those who considered the pill a boon for men was Hugh Hefner, founder of Playboy magazine. Although criticized often for the magazine's soft porn, nearly nude centerfolds, Hefner considered himself a feminist. A political liberal who promoted women's reproductive rights, he favored birth control and called for legalized abortion as early as 1965. The Playboy Foundation that he founded supported reproductive rights, child care centers for working mothers, and research on human sexuality. But for all of his support for women's rights, his magazine was not the place to find it. Women's bodies were certainly portrayed in a positive light, but women's activities outside the bedroom, less so. In the section of the magazine touted as the place where serious issues were discussed, men commented on women's desires for emancipation. They made it clear, as did Hefner, that women's sexuality should be liberated for the pleasure of men, but not for the women themselves. Playboy supported the pill in the 1960s. Hefner wrote editorials blasting the Catholic Church for its opposition to birth control, but Playboy's enthusiasm for women's reproductive freedom stopped short when it came to women who did not want to take the pill. While endorsing the pill and advocating its use, the magazine demeaned any woman who complained about side effects and didn't want to take the pill. For example, in response to one letter to the editor, Playboy quoted a psychiatrist who claimed, quote, "Women will tolerate side effects if they enjoy sexuality, do not perceive their husbands as being excessively sexually demanding, and feel generally responsible for managing family planning." In other words, women who didn't want to take the pill were considered to be irresponsible, not appropriately submissive, or frigid, or all of the above. As you can tell, Playboy had nothing to say about men's responsibility in all of this. It was all women's responsibility and men's freedom. Meanwhile, experts writing in women's magazines, including Red Book, The Ladies' Home Journal, and others, offered a very different message about men and the pill. They warned women that if they take the pill and demonstrate sexual eagerness as a result of their newfound freedom from fear of pregnancy, their husbands might become impotent. For example, the noted psychotherapist Rollo May said that because women take the pill, quote, "men are withdrawing from sex. Impotence is increasing. Men feel like drone bees." Another source of uneasiness came from the Beats, a group known for their disregard of social and sexual norms. Beatnik men were flamboyant in their flaunting of any sexual mores, heterosexual or homosexual. But they didn't all welcome the pill. A poem by Beat poet Richard Brautigan, dedicated to his girlfriend at the time, expresses a grim sentiment. The poem is titled "The Pill Versus the Spring Hill Mine Disaster," titled after a 1958 mining accident in Nova Scotia in which trapped miners died. The poem reads thus: "When you take your pill, it's like a mine disaster. I think of all the people lost inside of you." Whether or not the pill was a boon for men or a bust, millions of women took it anyway. Some hoped that there would be a pill for men too, so that the burden of contraception could be shared. As early as the 1950s, researchers claimed that a pill for men was just around the corner. But researchers were never able to develop a pill that would be acceptable to men because the side effects were too severe. Most of the compounds tested caused decreased libido or impotence. That was a problem. Nevertheless, research continued and still continues with some promising signs. But the male pill never made it to market. As late as last year, when I was completing this book, press reports promised that a male contraceptive is just around the corner, the same message that was coming out 50 years ago. But pharmaceutical companies are reluctant to invest the amounts of money that it would take to develop a male pill. They don't believe that there would be an adequate market for the pill. After all, men are not at risk of getting pregnant. But it's not true that there has been very little effort in this regard, as many people believe. There's been a huge amount of effort, and in fact, surveys show that men say that they are willing to take a contraceptive pill as long as the side effects are acceptable. That's, of course, the big question. Research continues. There are actually people at this university who are working on it, especially some non-hormonal compounds that might not have the same side effects and problems. So we'll see. So there's many myths and misperceptions about the pill. One of them is that the pill was and is easy to get and easy to use. Not true. In 1960, 22 states still prohibited the use of contraceptives, even when the FDA approved the pill. In 1965, in a landmark decision, Griswold versus Connecticut, the Supreme Court ruled that states could not prohibit the use of contraceptives for married people, but not for single people. It was still prohibited in many states. It wasn't until 1972 in Eisenstadt versus Baird that the Supreme Court extended that right to unmarried people. Nevertheless, millions of women took the pill as soon as it became available, and there's no question that it unleashed a contraceptive revolution. But even today, and we can talk more about this later, the pill is not necessarily easy to get, not necessarily accessible, affordable, or available. And that continues to be a problem 50 years down the road. Whether or not the pill unleashed a sexual revolution is another matter and another myth. One of the biggest myths out there, and the one that I encountered the most as I was doing this research, is that the pill sparked the sexual revolution. And after the work I did, I think I can say conclusively, it did not. We have absolutely no evidence that the pill had anything to do with the sexual revolution, which began long before 1960 and unfolded over several decades. We don't even know how many unmarried women took the pill until 1972, the first year that such data was collected. Now, that's kind of odd because throughout the 1950s and 60s, sociologists and sex researchers were obsessed with the sexual behavior of unmarried men and women. And we know a lot about what they did with each other's bodies, but we know nothing about their contraceptive practices, nothing at all. That question was never asked. Not until 1972. But we do have anecdotal evidence that suggests that very few unmarried couples had their first sexual encounter because the pill was available. And that's where you would have to look to see if the pill actually sparked the sexual revolution. Were young women just waiting until, whoopee, the pill is now available. I'm going to go find someone to have sex with. Didn't happen. As John Rock noted pointedly, reflecting the attitudes of many other birth control pioneers of his generation when the pill came out, and they were all asked about this. No, he said, the pill really wouldn't make any difference. And he said, and this shows what their attitudes were like, quote, any high school kid can get other contraceptives and probably knows about Saran Wrap. Betraying his disdain for sexually active young single women, he quipped that contraceptives were readily available, quote, for naughty little girls who want to use them. Naughty little girls. Studies show that even in the late 1960s, the majority of college women were virgins when they graduated from college, and those who were not did not engage in sex simply because the pill was available. And the evidence we have about that is rich and interesting. And pretty conclusive. And I have lots of examples of that, but I don't have time for all of them right now. There's another myth, and that is that the Catholic Church has always been consistently and solidly opposed to birth control. Not true. the church almost changed its policy in the 1960s, came this close. Pope John convened the Second Vatican Council in 1962, which led to many reforms. The ban on birth control was under discussion when Pope John died in 1963. In 1964, his successor, Pope Paul VI, appointed a commission to study the matter. And in 1967, a report leaked to the press revealed the large majority of church leaders on this commission favored approving birth control. And that message came out, went public, and went ballistic. There was widespread expectation that the church was about to lift the ban. A song by a Scottish songwriter, sung by Pete Seeger, expresses this anticipation. Song interlude number two.
Sorry.
The pill.
Magic touch. Thank you.
I won't have any more because they're going to bless the pill. I can't sing the song in English, you know. It was written by my friend Matt McGinn of Glasgow, Scotland. He says, I don't want anybody to take offense. You know, it's the Scotch Presbyters up here who are standing pat. Down in Rome, they're having arguments. I went when I was 17. I hadn't many brains. Says I, the very thing to do is fill the house with wains. But when I got the room full, I went to see the priest to tell him my man Willie is behaving like a beast. Ah, the pill, I'm pining for the pill. I won't have any more because they're going to bless the pill. Gave me such a talking to, it filled my eyes with tears. How long have you been wed, says he, says I, for 7 years. He says, you better give over all your evil, sinful tricks. You've been married 7 years and you only got the six. I'm pining for the pill. I won't have any more because they're going to bless the pill. In my faith have I been true. The very last time I counted them, I tallied 22. Now I'm running out of the notion, and we're running short of names. The Willie, he would welcome more, he's very fond of Wayne's. Ah, the pill, the pill, I'm pining for the pill. I won't have any more, because they're going to bless the pill. And now they're talking of the pill, it fills me heart with hope. I'm sitting here and waiting on the message from the Pope. I went downtown and bought some at 15 bob a tin. I hope we hear the Pope's okay before the man comes in. Ah, the pill, I'm planning for the pill. I won't have any more because they're going to bless the pill. Ah, pudding club, they're going to bless the pill.
I hope we hear the pill's okay before my man, the Pope's okay before my man comes in. Great little song. And it gives you a sense of the spirit of anticipation at the time that the ban would be lifted. But as we know, that did not happen. There was a small minority of church leaders who were involved in the commission who persuaded the Pope not to go along with the majority, but to hold fast on the teachings of the church, which actually wasn't as deeply historical as is often thought. All of the reproductive policies of the church developed during the 20th century, more or less, and the Pope just wasn't willing to upend the ban that had been in effect for decades by that time. So it stayed. Nonetheless, Catholic women took the pill at the same rate as non-Catholic women, and what this shows us is that, as with many other institutions of life, it changed the relationship between lay Catholics, large numbers of church leaders, and the papacy. Many priests began telling their parishioners to use their consciences as their guide rather than the laws of the papacy. And this was true for a lot of other institutions. The pill was really at the center of a lot of shifting relationships between doctors and patients, between pharmaceutical companies and consumers. And you see that very strongly, too, in the shift between Catholic leaders and Catholic members. They didn't suddenly, relinquish their relationship to the church, but they did separate their own behavior from church teachings in a pretty big way. So that's another myth that I think we are not necessarily so aware of, is just how much discussion and debate this issue generated. There's another set of myths, and I won't go into this in great detail, but there's been a lot of questions raised about the initial testing of the pill, about racism and sort of imperial designs, and especially around some of the tests, the clinical trials that took place in places, particularly in Puerto Rico. And that's a very interesting story, but what is usually not fully understood up to this point, and there's been a lot of really good feminist medical history work that's been done on this, is that in Puerto Rico, prior to the arrival of these clinical trials, there was only one available means of contraception, and that was sterilization. And when the pill trials were begun in Puerto Rico, Puerto Rican women lined up for blocks to join. They had to create waiting lists because there weren't enough spaces to include all the women who wanted to be on these trials, because they were desperate for a reversible non-surgical method of contraception. So we have to kind of look in context to each of these settings to see what was going on. You know, there may be questions about motivations of some of the people who established clinics or trials in different places. One thing that we do know is that in every community that's been studied, poor, non-white, American, or elsewhere, women want to be able to control their fertility. They want access. And even if they're not sure of what the motives are of the people who are bringing in their supplies or medications, they still want to be able to control their fertility. They have for centuries. They have since time began, probably, in human history. So today, the pill is used by millions of women around the world. In the United States, it's the most popular form of birth control, especially for young women. For older women who don't want any more children or who don't want any children at all, sterilization is actually the contraceptive of choice. But the pill is the most popular form of contraception available today. 80% of all American women of childbearing age have taken the pill at one point or another, 80%. We also know that the pill is safe. The pill actually saves lives, because if we look at the rates of illness and death as a result of complications of pregnancy and childbearing compared to the pill, there's no question that the pill saves lives. There's also now been a lot of evidence showing that the pill actually decreases the likelihood of getting certain kinds of cancers, especially ovarian cancer, which is very dangerous. Women today have a wide range of opinions about the pill, pro and con. In response to an internet query that I put out there on the web, I heard from hundreds of women with many different stories and perspectives. And here's a few to give you just the range, short ones. One woman wrote and said, "I love the pill." Another one wrote and said, "The pill sucks." Some take the pill for granted. One young woman wrote and said, quote, "The pill seems so commonplace. It's like asking what the impact of the telephone system is. I just couldn't picture a fairly functioning society without it." Others deeply appreciated it and understood the background and what others in earlier generations did to make this possible. According to one young woman, she considers it, quote, "the single most empowering option that women have been given in all of history." Another woman wrote, quote, "It helped me to own my identity as a woman and to be in control of my life, my body, and my future." Another one said that she feels like, quote, "one of the lucky women in the world to be born in the United States and to be born after the pill was available. I've never been forced to have children or been forced to abort because I never had an opportunity to protect myself. I've been able to live the life I wanted to lead, and most importantly, I never had to rely on the consent or willingness of my partner to protect myself. It's all been in my hands. I think that's huge, and I'm grateful for it every day. Margaret Sanger and Catherine McCormick would certainly smile if they heard that. For some young women, the taboo continues. We know that when the pill came out, one of the reasons that it didn't immediately spark a sexual revolution is because deeply ingrained cultural values like the double standard are not something that are likely to be turned over by the development or arrival of any technology. And those kinds of sentiments still continue today. One young woman describes that when she was in college, quote, "The crazy thing is that I never even considered the pill. Between my parents, my religious upbringing, and poor sexual education, I was under the impression that girls that used the pill were sluts." That's a word I thought went out 40 years ago, but I heard it a lot in these letters. I did. And I was surprised. I couldn't visit a gynecologist because my mother would somehow find out that I had been having sex and she would lose all trust in me or be really disappointed. I couldn't bear the thought of my friends finding out either. I was so afraid of losing their respect and becoming dirty in their eyes. Well, this young woman, in her junior year, attended a free seminar on women's health. Quote, "As my sexual education expanded, I stumbled into feminism and began to realize just how many choices the pill affords me. I would never stay with a man who would presume to dictate what I did with my body and sexual health." Some women today use the pill for reasons other than contraception, such as this woman in the military. And I thought the stories like this were really fascinating because these are not the stories you would have heard at all 50 years ago. So here's a soldier, and she writes, quote, "My job in the military required me to work in remote areas. We lived in tents, used porta-johns, and got showers every 3 days or once a week. We would do this for weeks or months. This was our job. I needed to know when my periods would come and what they would be like. There were very few women in my field, and I knew that I would be looked at as an example of what all women in the military would be like. I would not be viewed as an individual. The pill was invaluable." So here's a woman, she's not using it for birth control at all. All of the respondents who wrote to me, whether they personally took the pill, believed it should be available, they all believed it should be available, accessible, and affordable, even if they didn't like it for themselves and never wanted to take it. Many of them still had problems getting the pill due to conscience clauses or the lack of subsidies that made pills too expensive for them. Many of them complained that healthcare providers could simply deny them something that was legal and available by saying, "I don't believe in this and I'm not going to let you have it." Many complained about abstinence-only education, depriving them of the information they needed to make wise decisions about their health care. So even after 50 years on the market, the pill is not available to everyone who wants it, and we know that it's also caught in current political debates, both in terms of domestic policy and foreign policy, and that lately those have gotten worse, and that the pill has now been incorporated into debates about abortion, which is really unfortunate because whatever side of the abortion debate you find yourself on, most people involved in that debate think that, you know, birth control would be a good thing because there'd be fewer abortions, right? But it doesn't seem to work that way in terms of the politics of contraception and reproductive rights. And that is unfortunate. Looking back over the 50 years since the pill came on the market, the pill did not solve the world's population problems. It did not solve any of the world's problems that were anticipated at the time. It did not eradicate poverty. It did not eliminate unwanted pregnancies or guarantee happy marriages. But it was a major player in many of the most dramatic and contentious issues of the last half of the 20th century. The quest for reproductive rights, the authority of medical, pharmaceutical, religious, and political institutions, changing sexual mores and behaviors, foreign policy and foreign aid, and, of course, women's emancipation. The pill did not cause any of these developments, nor did it determine the outcome. but it played a critical role and served as a hot-button issue for the debate in the midst of social and cultural upheaval. For American women, without the gains of the feminist movement, the pill would have been just one more contraceptive, more effective, more convenient than those that came before, but not revolutionary. Instead, because of the feminist movement and all of the opportunities that have opened up for women and all of the political and cultural upheavals that came along in the last 50 years, the pill became a flashpoint for major social transformation. Women used the pill as a powerful tool, not only to control their fertility, but also to change their lives. Thanks. I think I'll stop there and see if you have some questions or comments. Or songs. Sing any songs. Rudy.
Thank you for that talk. I'm curious, though, is how did the name just come about?
That is such a great question, and you're not the first person who's asked it, but, I don't know the answer. I think it was almost immediate that the birth control pill became the pill. And it's surprising because there were so many other earth-shaking, scientific developments. There was the cure for polio. There was the prevention of polio. There were antibiotics that didn't become the pill. There were all kinds of things. And, I don't know. I think part of it is just the power of what the pill could do. And also the fact that, and this is, I think, interesting, and I'm not sure if it's directly related to what your question is, but the birth control pill was the first pharmaceutical product, the first medication developed for healthy people. Never before had there been a pharmaceutical product that had gone into this kind of research and development and testing to give to people who were perfectly healthy. Wasn't going to cure anything. So I think that also made a difference. It wasn't talked about in that way, but researchers were very, very aware of that. And I think it was the media that just kind of took it over and, people started saying, are you on the birth control pill? Are you on the pill? And it just, if you figure that millions of women jumped on it as soon as it was approved, and even before, there was great anticipation. And in the mid-1950s, the same compound was actually developed to treat infertility with the idea that for short-term use, if a woman took this compound, took this pill, it would suppress ovulation. And then when they went off the pill, their bodies would spring back and they would ovulate and get pregnant. And so it was effective as a tool as a medication for infertility and for what they called menstrual disorders. Well, suddenly, as soon as it was approved for that purpose, 500,000 women showed up at their doctors with menstrual disorders, something that had never been really diagnosed or treated in the past. They knew, of course, if it suppressed ovulation, they weren't going to get pregnant, and their doctors knew it too. So, I think there was so much anticipation about it. It was such a big deal that this shorthand just emerged. But, it's a great question. And now after I've done this book, I want to go back and find the first use of the pill as a shorthand for the oral contraceptive. If you come across it, tell me. It's a great question. Okay, well, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thanks so much. Go outside and enjoy the weather and the trees, and thanks for showing up.